Step two looks a little bit like this, I think. If I am, the step is, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And so I'm still whining about the implication that I'm insane. And so we went through that drill about the crazy things I did, including the decision to drink. And I began to get a little closer to it, but they said that doesn't even matter really. It isn't about whether you're insane. All you got to get is that sanity is not part of your life. And the question is, what would sanity look like? What would it look like if a power greater than yourself restored you to sanity? What would that look like? And it sketches out over here. I'm here and I'm kind of basically at step one, but I'm circling the drain. I'm in the middle of the ocean. And I want to go over here to sanity. I want to go here. I want to move from this point over here. I want to go from where I'm circling the drain with everything that implies to some state of sanity, some state of mental health, some state of happy living, some state of being at peace with myself. Can I get there from here? Is not a bad place to start. And the answer is, I've only been trying since I was about 5 years old, and I'm still circling the drain. That gives you a little clue right there as how it's going to go. No, I can't do that. I cannot take myself to sanity. So there's got to be a power greater than me that'll take me beyond this point. That's the whole deal. And the entire concept is caught up in a chapter called We Agnostics, which I never read because I'm not an agnostic, and why bother? It might as well have been We Ethiopians or some crap like that, you know. Next. Step two is chapter four. And it has some remarkable exercises in it that are designed to take a guy like me and move me. It's just priceless. Incidentally, I want to go back just a little bit to Bill's story, because why would I even get here and want to go someplace else? There's an itch going on. And I remember thinking that if the task is for me to find myself in this book, I better start looking. And I'm looking at Bill's story one day. And that story always annoyed me, to tell you the truth. And I know you won't repeat that to anybody. Because here's the guy that's talking about, like, he had this white light experience. And I'm thinking, how nice for you, Bill. We're so glad you had that. If I could have a white light experience. Maybe. Here's a guy that says things like, God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. And I'm going, oh, give it a rest, Wilson. And one day, because of God's grace, I'm thinking about the 14th of August. On the 14th of August, I was a drunk in 1966. On the 15th of August, I was not a drunk and have not been a drunk since that time. And I did not do that. And it finally came home to me that God's impact on me was sudden and profound. I mean, that is moving right along, you know. He did not mull it over, baby. He just said, you got it. From failure, you from humility of knowing you are toast, you're asking, you got it. And I never drank again. And this room is full of exactly that. 64, 65 guys that one day, from their deep failure, they never drank again. And we didn't know it was our last drink, and we didn't quit. Quit? Are you kidding? I can't quit. No, it's removed. Well, then what is it that's contingent upon my maintenance of a spiritual condition? The contact, the relationship with God. The relationship. Because, and the other thing that was interesting to me about Bill's story is that he had this cathedral experience. Deeply moved, I wandered outside in Winchester Cathedral. And then you get the little thing about the doggerel on the tombstone. A guy named Bill Thetcher was buried there, and he was a beer drinker. And he died, and they did a little thing for him. But the most significant piece in the page is, deeply moved, I wandered outside. And the reason that we know that is because Wilson comes back to it on page 12 and on page 13, page 10 and 12. He says in Towns Hospital, with a couple of days of sobriety, that day in Winchester Cathedral came back to me. This was such a remarkable event in his memory that it survived all of his crazy drinking. He must have been in Winchester Cathedral, what, in the late, maybe 1818, before World War I. And now he's in Towns Hospital in 1935. About drank himself to death in the meantime. And this event came back to him. My time in Winchester Cathedral returned to me, he says. He says, the meaning of that moment returned to him. And he describes it this way in the book. He says, for a brief moment I had needed and wanted God and was humbly willing to have him with me, and he came. And he came. But soon the sense of his presence was blotted out by the clamor of worldly things, mostly those within myself. And I went through the same drill, you know. He had a cathedral experience. And then I realized, I've had cathedral experiences. Where is my cathedral? It's right here. It's in these meetings. How many times have we sat in these meetings? And maybe every 6 months, every 3 months, a feeling comes to me. I'm there, and I see a guy take a cake. I see some mope that can't stay sober a year ago, sober now. I see miracles in my life. I watch this transformation in the life of another human being, and I'm sitting in my cathedral, my meeting, my men's stag, the big top on Wednesday night, my little speaker meeting Monday night. I'm sitting one-on-one with some guy in my office on a Saturday morning. I'm listening to a fifth step. I'm praying. Whatever I'm doing, I'm in a meeting, I'm in connection with another AA, and for a brief moment, he came. And I was humbly willing to have him with me, and he came. And he came. And soon the sense of his presence is blotted out by the clamor of worldly things. The meeting's over, I get up, I go out and get my car, and I'm on the road, and somebody comes into my lane. And the sense of his presence is blotted out by the clamor of worldly things, mostly those within myself. I got it about Wilson and his cathedral experience. I've had it. I've had it. A couple times a year, maybe. Profoundly touched. Deeply moved. Humbly willing to have him with me. And he came. Every time. And so that leaves me with this. I've tasted the honey. I've tasted the honey. I'm a seeker. I'm a seeker, and a seeker is somebody that's been touched by God in such a way that nothing less will ever do. And every seeker needs a master, and you're my masters, because a master is someone whose life bears living witness to the seeker that what the seeker seeks is real. And we have AA. We have this. Designed by a remarkably kind God to bring us home, to meet every need we have. and I didn't even know it. But I couldn't leave you. No matter how much I brought into my life or how bad it was, I couldn't leave. I am brought here. I'm called here. And we all are. We are called to this place. And so, is there a power greater than I am that will restore me to sanity? I must believe that. And it's all that's required. There's another thing that's required, and that is that I be willing to go to any lengths, and I could say yes, yes, I'm willing. Gladly ready to go to any lengths. And there's another thing that's a part of this too, and that is God does not make too hard terms with those who seek Him. Is this hard? This is not hard. This is not hard. And this is as hard as it gets. God does not make too hard terms. He honors the slightest move in His direction. He does that. Yeah. Yeah, He does that. And so we're blessed. We're blessed. So am I willing to believe that some power greater than myself will take me to sanity? Yeah. Yeah, you know what? I am. And he says this, an interesting thing. Bottom of page 44, if we're in We Agnostics, the chapter that need not be read if you're like me. If a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. And they said, shift it just a little bit. What if it said, if the mere awareness of the AA principles or a better recovery program were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. Oh, I'd been aware of those AA principles. You bet, I've talked about them. Like the guy said, you believe in complete immersion in baptism? You believe in it? Hell, I've seen it done. No extra charge for that. I was in the best recovery program I knew about in the middle of the Pacific Group in Southern California. Big top, lots of people. If that had been enough, if these principles had been enough of being in the... We're going to meetings all the time. We're in service all the time. We're in unity all the time. Commitments and calling our sponsors every day and sponsoring other people and going down to whatever. Never say no to an AA request. And we didn't. We didn't. If a better recovery program would have gotten the job done, I would have recovered long ago. It's important to get that. Because what's missing out of that is a relationship with God. Because when He tells us, there is a chapter that has a really elusive title to it called, There is a Solution. Which is a promise in itself, isn't it? The title. And what does he say the solution is? Wilson is not easy to read. Because he doesn't label what the solution is. But at the end of the chapter, he kind of lays it on you. Because he says here, on page 28, if what we have learned and felt and seen means anything at all, it means that all of us, whatever our race, creed, or color, are the children of a living Creator with whom we may form a relationship upon simple and understandable terms as soon as we are willing and honest enough to try. It's the relationship. On the other page, he says, each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. That is the solution. A relationship with God. It's not enough to have the principles. It's not a better recovery program isn't going to take us home. We must get in relationship. I had a guy in my office the other day on Saturday. He describes himself as a Jewish atheist. Whatever that may mean. And this guy has been around a while, 14 and a half years, 14 years and 9 months. He keeps correcting me when I say that. And he's a very powerful figure in the entertainment industry. He managed U2 a few years ago. I mean, he has been around and done the deal. He knows where all the bones are buried in Hollywood, and he's quite an interesting character, except that he can't manage his life. He can manage you too, but he can't manage his life. And he's desperate. But he's an atheist. And he can't believe, and when the word God comes up, he bristles. He's okay with spirit of the universe. But if you go to God and it gets personal. I said, I got the worst possible news for you. It doesn't matter whether you call it Spirit of the Universe with which you agree or God that makes you want to throw up. It doesn't matter. But what matters is that you can't go where you want to go unless you're willing to be in relationship with some power greater than you. Relationship is different than knowing about. It's different than believing in. How would you like to ever see a girl that you just wanted to be in relationship with her so much? Would it satisfy you to know about her? Not really. Would you like to say, you know, I think I'm in relationship with her because I believe in Jane. Oh, really? Is that what you really want? That takes you home, does it? Believing in her? Well, no, I'd like to date her. Oh, it's not enough. It's not enough. Nor is it enough to have a God that's way out there, the one we were taught about when we were kids. It is not enough. And we get that finally in this chapter, where he is. See, when I thought he was way out there, it's a little comforting in a sense, isn't it? Because maybe he won't bother me a lot. But I'm practicing the absence of God when I'm doing that. And even when I think he's inside me, finally I'm willing to look at that, although I don't know why he would be because I'm not a fit host for God. I think he's in me like a pebble is in a glass of water. Or maybe he's in me on my better days like a raisin is in a bun. And when you told me that he's inside me like the ocean is in a wave, it made me weep. It made me weep. Because it really describes something much different than I ever imagined. But we start with this in chapter 4. Step 2. He says, don't let, on page 47, the first assignment they asked me to read, do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. And I didn't ask them why they wanted me to do this, but what they wanted me to do was to take the spiritual terms in chapter 4, ask God to set aside my prejudice, which is just prejudging the term, and ask myself what it meant to me. And I said, okay, what are the spiritual terms? They said, use the capitalized terms in the chapter as spiritual terms. Just assume those are spiritual terms. There's only 18 or 19 of them. Make a list of them. Set aside your prejudice. Just set it aside. Just let it go. So much is available to us by letting stuff go. Let it go. And ask yourself, under your mind, way down deep in your heart where you really live, in your gut someplace, does this term have any meaning for you? And I found that each of these terms had meaning for me. As I went farther into the list, I discovered that it was getting more heartfelt and less heady. And I came back to him with my list. And we got a little deeper on some of the stuff that I was heady about. I mean, what does a supreme being mean to me? That's the ultimate in power. But it's a discrete entity, a being. What is the realm of spirit? Today, I think, it's the right side of the page. But that's it. The place, the realm, means reality. Realty. It's this place where God is. Where God is. Power, we know what that. All-powerful, guiding, creative intelligence. What is that? Well, it's an extraordinary supreme being that is not just powerful, but guiding. That suggests that he's in touch with me, if I'm fine with that. Creative intelligence. The most incredible intelligence that creates all things. I mean, to go down that list and to get in touch with that, what I really think underneath the crap from the Church of the Air in Billings, Montana, underneath what my mother told me, underneath all the prayers, underneath everything, is a deep awareness in me that I have a sense of what this power is. And when I got that done, they came, took me back to the book, and they said, at the start, this was all we needed to commence spiritual growth, to affect our first conscious relation with God. And I had a first conscious relation with God, as I understood Him. And afterward, I found myself accepting many things which seemed entirely out of reach before I had started that process. That's just the first exercise in We Agnostics. And I'm on my way. They asked me to assume a reasonable starting point, make a reasonable assumption on page 48. The reason we believe in electricity is because we have a reasonable assumption as a starting point. And that is, there's some connection between that switch and these lights. What's my reasonable assumption? That a power exists that'll take me beyond this point. That's all I need. That's the next step in the thing. What am I going to do then? I'm going to ask myself, what would sanity look like if it were in my life? And they took me to the bedevilments on page 52, to this little paragraph that said we were having trouble with personal relations. We couldn't control our emotional nature. We were prey to misery. What would each of the, and they, when they, that was first used as a test for chronic untreated alcoholism. I'm 23 years sober, and they said, here's the test. We don't know if you qualify for this program or not, but we're going to give you a shot. We were having trouble with personal relationships. Is that true for you? I said, well, you mean just because my girlfriend left me and my partner won't do business with me anymore? Yeah, I guess that's right. We couldn't control our emotional natures. Yeah, that applied. We were prey to misery. Yeah, prey to depression. Yeah, couldn't make a living. Yeah. Had a feeling of uselessness, full of fear, unhappy, couldn't seem to be a real help to other people. And they told me, they said, add a 10th category. You're going to have to get to it sooner or later. Add sane sex life. You got anything like sane sex life going on for you? I said, no. I just knew it. Because when there's sexual tension, I just don't really act well. And so I had to look and see, what would sanity look like in this little area? We were having trouble with personal relationships. What would that look like if God removed the problem? Well, I guess those relationships would be loving, wouldn't they? I guess there would be fidelity involved. I guess there would be real respect. I guess I would, if I said, what would sanity look like in this area where I can't control my emotional nature? What would that look like? I'd be safe to be around. See, it's my expression of anger that shames me because it's so inappropriate. Is it about not ever being angry again? No. Is it about expressing it cleanly and appropriately? Yes. Yes. It's that. It's that. Is it about, what about, we were a prey to misery, a victim to misery, what would sanity look like? I'd have an ongoing sense of well-being. What about depression? I think the opposite of depression is expression. I would say it. I wouldn't just jam it down. I would say it. I wouldn't just jam it down. That's what sanity would look like, just in that area. This is not rocket science. We couldn't make a living. What would that look like, that area in my life with sanity in it? Well, I guess, number one, I would have abundance in my life. I would share it with others. It would come in easily. My creditors would be real happy with me. That. Had a feeling of uselessness. I would be useful and I would be aware of it. Full of fear. I would be full of love. We were unhappy. I would be happy. Couldn't seem to be a real help to other people. I would be useful to other people. Sane sex life. I would have relationships that really were respectful and mutually satisfying. And have fidelity and commitment and keep my agreements. I mean, it's not a mystery. When, if you write down the 20 craziest things you ever did, just look at how it really you wanted it to go. And it gives you another shot at it. one of the craziest things I ever did. I slapped a child. Oh, God, I could tell you that the terrible sense of failure and insanity that I had as I looked on the face of that child, how, that look on that child's face is insane. And what would sanity look like? That kid would be loving me, and I'd be loving him. That's sanity. No strings attached, just loving. And we know that. And we want to go there. And we have to define it. And they made me a remarkable promise. And it's a promise that turned out to be a good one. Because they said, if at step two you can... See, what we're looking for is a vision of sanity. At step 10, it says, it's every day we carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. Now, that's our vision of God's will. We're never going to know God's will for us, but we can have a vision of that, and we need a vision of that. And they said, if you can form a vision of sanity at step 2 and do the rest of the steps very thoroughly, by the time you get to step 10, you'll have no more and no less in your life than the vision that you formed at step 2. I signed on. I liked the promise. I said, that's the way that it is. We're going someplace. We're going someplace. This is a journey. You know what a journey is in the dictionary? A day's trip. And it is a trip. Yeah. Broad highway, we're moving. We're on our way. All right. So that's it. And I formed a vision of sanity. And then I had something else that they wanted me to do. They asked me the weirdest question. They said, and we're going through the book line by line, but the exercises are what I'm describing now. Is God everything or nothing? Is that a rude question? Well, I know he's not nothing. But everything... I don't think he's everything that he's cracked up to be. You know, I'm always into the middle road. I know that my choices are pretty clear. I can either, as it says on page 25, go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation as best I could, and I was doing that at 23 years of sobriety. Going on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. And my other choice, to accept spiritual help. Why am I looking for the middle ground? Because I don't have control on the other two that are available to me. If I accept spiritual help, I'm out of control. If I'm going on to the bitter end, blotting out the tolerable condition I'm in, I'm out of control. It's like when we're new, I could crawl around on the floor of the garage barking like a fox, or I'm afraid if I do anything else, God will send me to China. Either way, I don't have any control. My ego is not happy with that. And so I'm looking for middle ground. I'm looking for middle ground. I knew I should accept spiritual help, but what's my middle ground? Go to lots of meetings. Are they important? Yes. Am I glad I went to lots of meetings? Yes. Do I still go to lots of meetings? Yes. Does it take me to a point where I'm willing to accept spiritual help? No. Not automatically. What'll I do? Where's my middle ground? You know what? It gets pretty subtle. My middle ground goes like this. I don't want to actually accept spiritual help, but I will ask for it. Is that cute? I'm in there praying, asking for spiritual help. Oh, God, help me get over my self-obsession. The phone rings. Somebody says, can you help me? No, not now. I'm busy praying for... Take the middle ground. Take the middle ground. It's perfect. So the middle ground is God, everything or nothing. And they say, and I said, you know, I'm just stuck. I just can't get past that question. And these guys were kind, and they knew I'd had a college education, so they took special care of me. Here's how it goes. Here's the question. What five things will you not give up for a better relationship with God? Is that rude? Well, I got five things. Let's say, let's start here with sex. Let's start here with control. Let's start here with greed. That old greed and groin combination, always a favorite of mine. Sounds like a restaurant, doesn't it? Let's go down to the greed and groin and have a steak. Here's one I like. One of my favorites is anger. Here's another one I'm happy with, rage. Why? Keeps them away. Keeps them, it gives me the illusion of control. Here's another one I like is career. And my all-time personal favorite is image. In those days, each of those were 2, 4, 6, 7. I think I had about 7 on my list. Each of these things was more important to me than a better relationship with God. Isn't that great? Isn't that wonderful? Down here, I'll put BRWG, better relationship with God, was at the bottom of this list. And if you go home and you take a look at this, you come up with your own list, whatever it is. But now at least we know the answer to the question. Is God everything or nothing? Neither one. This is everything. And God's at the bottom of the list of everything. Number 8 on a list of 8. You got to know where you're playing with this. And yet we're fighting the wisdom of the ages. Remember when he said, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me"? There they are. He came down from the mountaintop with those tablets and he said, "I got good news and I got bad news." Moses said that. And he said, "Well, what's the good news?" He said, "Well, I got him down to 10. What's the bad news? Adultery's still on the list. There's no extra charge for this. Or, said another way, where am I going for power? I'm going here. This is my power. My attempt to get power comes from sex or control or greed or anger, rage, my career, my image. So now I'm getting a little whack at the answer. This is how I've been playing it. I won't go here until I've tried every one of these things. And then I don't really want a relationship. I just want a line of credit on the power. I'll write the check. Thanks. I'll spend it the way I want to spend it. That's the way I play the game. And that's the answer to the question, is God everything or nothing? And the solution to the question is not anything less than having a better relationship with God, the most important thing in my life. More important than any of these things. Does it mean it's time for all these things to leave my life? No. No, 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 no. I don't want my career to go out of my life. I don't want sex to go out of my life. Sometimes anger can be useful. I don't want those things out of my life, any of them. They don't have to go out of my life. But they better be less important than a better relationship with God, or I don't dare take that third step prayer, because when I say, relieve me of the bondage of self, that's the bondage of self. That's it. That's it. And so, the technique they gave me was very easy. You look at this list at night, you ask God to take you to a place where you're gladly ready to have these items less important to you than a better relationship with God. And you look at the list in the morning and to see if you can draw a line through any of these things. Put it down below this line. And I looked. And the first thing I was willing to say is less important was rage. I don't remember what order they came in, but it was within 2 weeks. Everything was down below the line, or said another way, the better relationship with God was at the top. And we're still in step 2. We're still in this remarkable chapter I never read because the title's bad. And then we'll take a break, and when we come back, I want to talk to you about the last piece. This is very critical here. In fact, I was going through this with another guy. as I do. And Jim was writing his list, and I decided I would write my list again. And I discovered the damnedest thing, and this was about 4 months ago. I discovered there is something that's more important to me than a better relationship with God. That day I was writing that list, and that is my reputation as being really good with taking people through the steps. Once I put a virtue on it, I'm just dead meat. You know, and I had to go through this process again. It just sneaks in there. But once you kind of wake up a little bit, things begin to shift. And so when we come back, we're going to talk about that last piece, and we're going to talk about waking up. 10 minutes. Okay, here we go for the last session this morning. Shall we do it together, or am I going to do a solo flight? There may not be any real point in finishing it alone. Anybody here ever hear about a guy or listen to any tapes by Anthony DeMello? He talks about waking up. He says we have to wake up. We don't want to wake up. Or we think we're awake and don't need to wake up. And he told an interesting story one day about a guy that was under a bridge in London on the River Thames. And he was just settling in for the night, getting his newspaper around him, and foggy, cold, rainy night. He had his newspaper and an old blanket, and he was settling in for the night, and he fell asleep there by the river under the bridge, began to dream, and in his dream a big limousine pulled up. Beautiful woman got out of the limousine, marched over to where he lay there on the concrete, and said, "What are you doing here? My good man, what are you doing here?" And he said, "I live here. This is where I stay." She said, "You mean you're going to stay here all night?" He said, "I always do." She said, "You mean you don't have any place you can go?" He said, "No, I haven't had for some time." She said, "Well, tonight, for once in your life, I'm going to have my man take you out to my estate at the edge of London. You're going to get clean clothing, you're going to get a bed, you're going to get warm food, you're going to get a shave and a shower, and you're going to have at least once in your life a comfortable night. And tomorrow when you wake up, we're going to feed you some more and give you the clothes you really need and send you on your way. But at least one night you'll have a wonderful, wonderful experience." And she did exactly that. She had her man take him out to the estate at the edge of London, and this guy could not believe his good fortune. And they gave him exactly what she had promised that they would give him, and put him into a clean bed in a nice little room, not like this room that Gary and I have with the jacuzzi and everything in it, but still it was a nice room. About midnight, she couldn't sleep. Beautiful woman. And she got up and put on a little wrap, a little silk wrap, and started walking around this large estate of hers, and ultimately walked down the servant's wing and saw light coming under the door, and she knew he was in that room, and she knocked on the door. And he said, "Come in." And she opened the door, and he's laying in bed, and she said, "How are you doing?" And he said, "Oh, my God, I'm doing wonderful. I'm just really doing beautifully." And she said, "Did you get some food?" He said, "Yes, they gave me marvelous food." "I see you got a shave and a shower." He said, "Yes, I did." "You got some clean clothes for tomorrow?" "Yeah, they fixed me up. They did exactly what, and now I have this wonderful warm bed." And she said, "Well, I was a little restless, and I woke up, and I wondered, would you like some company tonight?" And he said, "Yes, yeah." She stepped into the room and closed the door behind her, this gorgeous lady, and started to take a few steps over to the bed that he was in. And he moved over to make room for her on the bed. And when he moved over, he fell into the River Thames. I mean, we hate to wake up, right? It's like... we really don't want to wake up. We would rather use our little substitutes for a sense of being alive. And we don't want to really get this business about whether God is everything or nothing. We don't really believe we have other things first, or that we can possibly rearrange that, that it's really safe. The question that comes to every one of us, is what'll happen to me if I leap into the abyss? And right underneath that question is, what'll happen to me if I don't leap into the abyss? We think that leap is so unsafe. We were laughing the other day because somebody had reported some testing they did during the Vietnam War about airborne troops, green troops that were in combat zones, and airborne troops and seasoned troops were tested. And they were tested by putting electrodes on them as they were on their way to the drop zone. These guys would be operating autonomically at a certain level with their heartbeat and their respiration and their pulse and their temperature, blood pressure, all that stuff. And they'd be sitting there with their rifle between their knees, and then the jump master gets everybody on their feet, and everybody's autonomic nervous system responses increase. Blood pressure goes up, pulse goes up. Boom, boom, boom. Then they turn toward the door, and then they begin to shuffle toward the door, and they hook that static line to the overhead line, and they begin to boom, 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 and everything is going up. And by the time they get to the door and the jump master pops them on the headgear and they go out the door, they are amped up really good and all the way down. The seasoned troops had a completely different reaction to it. The new troops felt that it was dangerous to go out that door. The seasoned troops didn't change much at all. You know, when their autonomic nervous system impulses began to speed up was when they were very close to the ground, because they knew the jump is safe. It's that stop that'll get you into trouble if anything does. But the green troops didn't know that. The new guys didn't know that. And we're in the same position. People that have made the leap know the leap is safe, that it's a groundless leap, that our fears are groundless. But the interesting thing about this program is that it never asks us for blind faith. Never asks us for blind faith. It asks us for belief and it asks us for faith, but we know those. We have that inside us. Look that word belief up in the dictionary. It means an expectancy. That's all. And we had belief in booze, didn't we? Second, third, fourth time out, we have a belief in it. We expect it to do something for us, and it does until it doesn't. But we also have faith. Faith is a confident trust born of experience. A confident trust born of experience. Did you ever buy a bottle, and you couldn't drink it right then, and you locked it in the glove compartment, and you felt better? That's faith. I remember going into the University of Oregon student health center. They give you a prescription of Dexamil. Didn't ask any questions. Boom, here you are. And it's just a piece of paper, and I put it in my pocket, and I, whew, that's better. That's better. Hi, let me open that door for you. Hello. You're so gracious, you know. That's faith. That's faith. We have that. But we've always had faith in what? Our mind, our stuff, our anger. I have faith in my rage. I have faith in sex, control, greed. Why? Because I get an illusion of power out of all of these things. I believe in this stuff. I have an expectancy about it. It isn't mysterious. But we come equipped with these things. And so the leap, we've made the leap many times. In many arenas. This is not new. I think drinking is a... I think alcoholic, knee-walking, snot-flying drunk is such good training for AA. You got to get totally involved in it. It's a day at a time. Takes you places you cannot go any other way. It's perfect training. And yet we kind of back away from this one because we want to explore all these other things first. And we can do that. We can do that. It doesn't take us where we want to go, but there it is. So the question is God everything or nothing? And we want to get to a point where we can say there is nothing in my life that's more important to me than a better relationship with God. We want to get to a point where we can say that's where I'll go first for my power. Now, do I go there first for my power? Not every time. Not every time. No. Do I get lustful thoughts and fantasies? Sure. Do I try to go there for power? Sure. Do I go there? Do I get angry and try to go there for power? Not so much. You know what my Achilles tendon, my Achilles heel is lust. I don't know what yours is. Some guys is greed. Some guys is control. Some guys. But we all have one. We all have one. But on balance, I start out my day, as I told you last night, in wanting to come down a completely different path. For a lot of reasons. One, I'm happier that way. Number two, I love the way my wife smiles at me when she feels secure and served. You know, did you know that the women that we're with have psychic knowledge about us? We wonder how they know what they know. You come home exactly when you say you're going to come home, but you've been at the wrong place before you got there, and they say, they got a little neuron that fires. We see the color green, the green neuron fires. We go, oh, that's green. We see her, oh, that's Linda. Oh, this neuron. They got a neuron that fires that says, I don't know what's up, but something's up, neuron. That neuron drives us crazy. Or normal, depending on where we are. Now, the last thing, and this is not like you can't sit here and go here. This is these exercises in chapter 4, the chapter I never read because of the bad title, are exercises that take, you can spend a month one-on-one with another guy getting through there. Is it worth the cab fare? You bet it is. You bet it is. And if you're taking somebody through the steps and going through these exercises, it takes a little bit. Is it worth it? Yeah. Yeah, that's the deal. That's the deal. And the last question that we want to ask is, and Wilson, Vintage Wilson on page 45, he says, but the point is to find a power that we can use, that we can tap into. And then he says, but where and how are we going to find this power? And then he answers those questions on page 55, as you know. And how are we going to find the power? What does he say about that on page 55? Sometimes we had to search fearlessly. That's how. That's how we find it. Where are we going to find it? The great reality is deep down within us. Deep within us. That's the great reality. In other words, it is inside me. Like the ocean is in a wave. Which means that we are not separate from each other or from God. He's inside me. Where is the center of God? Right there, and right there, and right there, and right here. It's spirit. And it's who we are. And there is a place in me where my divinity meets the divinity of the universe. It's just who we are. And I can't tell you how hard I fought that simple idea, because for one thing, I did not think I'm a worthy host. Why would God take up residence in me? And another thing is, I don't really want this relationship with God. I just assume He not even notice me. My mother used to say, what will you do when you meet your Maker? I don't know. Apologize, I guess. I don't know. Hey, sorry. Look, if she were here today and asked me, what will you do when you meet your Maker? I could tell her. We already met. I was 24 years sober. We met. And we've been friends since. Because He's not mad. isn't that hot? That cowboy says he's not pissed off. I love that. I love that. He's not mad. All he is love. But I'm afraid he'll notice me. Such a strange idea. And I picked it up at the Church of the Air in Billings. Other people picked up different things. It wasn't that that's what they taught. It's what I picked up. So where is this power? And what am I going to do about that? The language in this book is exquisite. We think the leap is unsafe, but we're fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity. How have I obscured the idea of God by calamity? Well, what's my calamitous situation? What's the thing I hang on to? She threw me out of the bed. She doesn't love me. She died when I was only 14. That calamity. My stepmother didn't wake me up to take the Yale entrance examinations when I was in high. That calamity. God, think of who I'd been if I could have just gone to Yale. There can't be a God. Are you kidding? With a calamity like that befalling me? How can I obscure it by pomp? Pomp, I think, is like ceremony. I can obscure the idea of God by prayer, by ceremonial prayer, by religion, by getting so engrossed in some kind of religion that I drop the spirituality of it out. And that happens, you know, it's like the real struggles that I have a good friend that's a priest, and he struggled terribly coming to AA because he lost his identity, and that almost kills us. I lost my identity when I was 23 years sober. And the reason it was so painful and the reason the death was so terrible is because I thought life was about who I am. And so does my friend the priest. He did. And it turns out that it's about whose I am. Whose. But I didn't get that for a while. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things. What did I worship that obscured the fundamental idea of God? Oh, let me refer to my list. Sex, control, greed, anger, rage, career, image. Yeah, worship that. Worship my mind, worship my stuff. Here's the way we worship it. You ever think about if I see a guy and I don't like that guy, I say, I don't like him. He's not a very good person. I don't like him. Like those two are related. Like my emotions about the guy tells me anything about what kind of a person he is. The two are unrelated, yet I think they're related. I'm worshiping my emotions. Oh, he's a great guy. I really like him. No kidding. You think he's a great guy because you like him? Yeah. Well, I'm worshiping my... He may be, may not be, but how would my emotions... How would just a couple of neurons firing make a bit of difference about who he is? But I worship my emotions. But this idea of God in every man, woman, and child is in there someplace. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. So we saw that faith in some power greater than we are is part of our makeup. We come equipped with belief and faith. We come equipped with that. We had to search fearlessly, but he was there just as much a fact as we were. The great reality is deep down within us. And then he gives us an extraordinary sentence. He says this, in the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. What does that mean? Well, that word last means how I've analyzed this to death. And when I find this power, it is the last analysis. I never analyze it again. Remember before you had that first great love, that first great sex, and you were constantly, we all constantly analyzed, wonder what it'll be like, wonder what it, had a lot of questions about, a lot of imaginings, and then we have that experience and we don't analyze it again. We go, got it. Wow. Let's do it again. But we know something we never could know any other way. It's the last analysis. And then he says, it is only there that he may be found, only deep within me. Not here, not in my list of things that I go to first. No, no, I won't find him there. Only there, only deep within me, that he may be found. And so now we get another one of his checklists. We can only clear the ground a bit if our testimony helps one sweep away prejudice. Has what I have, is what you are saying to this guy you're taking through the steps designed to sweep away his prejudging of all of this? Is his experience in the book so far designed to sweep away his prejudging? Is his own participation in these exercises going to sweep away prejudging? Yeah. If it does, if it helps sweep away prejudice, if it enables you to think honestly, I mean, for the first time, see how I've been playing the game. Think honestly about the notion that I have relegated God to some sort of a banker that might give me a line of credit on the power. If it encourages me to search diligently within myself, if I'm thinking honestly, if I have let my prejudice go, and if I am searching diligently within myself, we have a remarkable promise here. It says, if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. If you wish and have met these little conditions, you can join us on the broad highway. That's an extraordinary promise. That is just an absolutely extraordinary promise. And the only the difference between unity and service and recovery, there's a different energy involved. I can get more unity by going to more meetings and getting more involved in a group. I can get more service by picking up another panel or a commitment at a meeting. I can, by force of my own will, get more involved. The recovery piece of it is more letting go. And my refusal to let go imprisons me. Remember that story about the guys that were years ago? They would go into Africa to trap and bring back monkeys for sale in the United States for research or for zoos or for circus, whatever. And they had a heck of a time trapping these monkeys, because if they really secured them in a trap, they might die or another animal might come by and pick them off. And they were really unsuccessful. And somebody taught them a very interesting thing. What you do if you want monkeys is you have a base camp and then you go some distance away, and on the jungle floor you put a lot of vases down spread apart at irregular intervals. Heavy iron long-necked vases. And in those vases you put some nuts, some sweet-smelling nuts. And these vases have such a narrow, long neck that the monkey can get his hand and arm in there and grab those nuts. But when he's grabbed those nuts, he can't get his arm back onto there. And he can't let go of the nuts. Cannot do it. And the guys go back to play cards at camp all day, and they come out the next morning, and here's a monkey. And he's got those nuts in his hand, and he's got this heavy iron jar, and he hasn't been able to get very far, and they don't have to listen, do anything but listen to figure out where he is, because he's mad. Because they have made a monkey out of him, and he is stuck with that heavy iron jar. He can't disappear into the brush, he can't do anything, he just squall and carry on, and they come up and they get him. They get him. Give him a little dart, tranquilizer, he lets go. And that's my life, story of my life. I won't let go of what? Of the idea that my answer is this stuff that's more important to me than a better, of the idea that God is going to hurt me. I won't let go of my notion that I can't trust another human being. I can't do that. I won't let go of that. And it is so imprisoning. Just to let go. It's like I laugh, I go down, I call up my sponsor, I say, I got a problem, I need to come down and talk to you. He says, okay. And I go in and I sit in his office and I got my vase and I put it there on his desk and I got all these problems and I'm talking to him about them and I just go, oh God, oh God. And we get, and after a while he gets me laughing, and then I forget about these problems. And I say, thanks. God, thanks a lot. You really helped me a lot. I get up and drag my jar out of his office, and I still have my jar because I haven't let go of anything in my life. And wonder why nothing ever changes. Because I won't let go. I won't let go. I won't let go. So, we need to let the prejudice go, think honestly, search diligently within ourselves. Then, if we want to, we can join others on the broad highway. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. At the very end of this chapter, and he spends a page talking about a guy that went through this process, but there's a remarkable sentence at the end of chapter 4. It says this. It says, when we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. A promise, a flat promise. So let me get this right, God. If I draw near to you, you will disclose yourself to me. I've met all of these conditions. I am willing. I want to do this thing. I want some information, some proof, some evidence that you're in me. That there is the question is there a place inside me where I can go where God is? I want that contact. I really want that contact. Man, I'm 24 years sober, and I'm doing this stuff, and I can't manage my life, and I get that. I really get that. And she's gone, and he's gone, and the money's gone, and the house is gone, and all I'm doing is hanging out with some guys that are taking me through this work. And I need desperately, I've always needed to be in touch with you, and I know now that nothing else will ever do, because it doesn't take me where I want to go. I can bring all the stuff into my life that I think will make me happy, and it doesn't stay long, and it doesn't make me happy while it's there. But we all have to find that out ourselves in our own way. But the quest now is, how am I going to, is there a place inside me where I can go where God is? Well, anytime we're going inside of ourselves in search of anything, we call that meditation. That's a meditative process. It's not a difficult process. It's not very fancy. It's just that we have to sit in a chair, stack up our spine, get our feet on the floor, and be willing to spend a few minutes inside. Inside. We have to be willing to let those thoughts just go through our mind and let them go. Let them go. We have to be willing to get in touch with our breathing. You know, breathing is kind of an important thing. It's symbolic in a sense. If there's a place inside of me where my divinity meets the divinity of the universe, the corollary with my breathing is that I am breathing, inhaling oxygen molecules that have been around since the creation, that have been broken down from carbon dioxide molecules that were exhaled by Abraham Lincoln. And they are used by nature to nourish itself, and then we get that back in the form of oxygen put out by nature. And my breathing is a point of contact between me and the universe. And I breathe in that air, and I let it go, and the rule of exchange takes place. The law of exchange is part of what's going on. I take it in, and I exchange it. I take it in and I exchange it. There is a connection between me and the universe. And we're up here in this beautiful place where we have water and trees all around us, this wonderfully beautiful universe. And there is a universe going on inside of me that reflects that. That reflects that. And so, the real quest is, can I find a place inside me where God is? They said, First of all, find a place that's safe. Go back in your mind. Go back into your childhood. Where did you feel safe? And at first I said I didn't feel safe because I got so mad at my mother it was never safe again, because I said, you don't love me? Great. I don't love you either. And she and I went to war. And then the next thing I know, I'm standing at her grave when I'm 14 years old and they're throwing dirt in there, and I'm thinking, you don't love me? I don't love you either. I didn't cry. I didn't even breathe deeply. I didn't breathe deeply for 2 years until they gave me some vodka.
that's better. That's better. But there was a time I was safe. And I had to look at that when I was 4. Before it came along. And my mom is tucking me into bed. And we're laughing and telling our secrets and loving each other. It was safe. So I would start there. In my mind, I would go there and I would get that. I would get that scent. Olfactory impulses are very basic. They are midbrain things. And it's scent. That's why that whole industry is so fabulously profitable. We marry people because they smell right. We avoid women that don't smell right. Why didn't you date her again? I don't know. I just didn't like the way she smelled somehow. She smelled bad? No? Didn't like it. I would get that scent of my mom and that sense of love and that sense of safety and that sense of being exactly where I wanted to be, totally trusting another human being, this remarkable mother of mine. I would go there. It all changed after that, but there is a place. Because you know what? We weren't born the way we became. I don't think that. I don't think so. I think that our earlier upsets created a lot of trouble. Just as he says in this step 8 part we read out of the 12 and 12. Go there and be there with my mom. And then it shifted. I would find safety and a sense of safety in which would allow me to relax deeper than I was able to relax. And then I shifted the scene, shifted to ocean, a forest, a floor, and a meadow in a forest. And I would be there, leaning against a huge tree. I was coming back on a flight from the East Coast one Sunday. We had a window seat. Going into LAX, and I'm thinking about all of this, and I go inside, and suddenly I'm on the ocean floor, and then the most amazing thing happened, a pewter pillar, huge pewter pillar coming out of the ocean floor, and I saw that, and I knew it was me, and I looked to see, where is all the scars where the law practice was ripped away, and where the relationship was ripped away, and all, and it was absolutely smooth, and I knew in an instant that none of that was me. And I keep looking and I keep looking and I'm down in, weeks went by and I'm down in San Diego in the middle of a trial. And I'm in the hotel room one morning and their part of the case is over. Now it's time to put on my part of the case, and which is the easier part because you know what's going to happen in your part of the case. And during their part of the case, you're kind of like on point all the time because that evidence is coming in at the speed of sound and you don't know quite what's coming up next and you're just really like that. But now it's my part of the case and I know what's going to happen. So I am more